This is the Poison Terminator Podcast. My name is Carlo Diolin. Today is a special day. It is International Overdose Awareness Day, and we will be talking about how we can prevent suicide by drug overdose with my guest, Dr. Kelly Posner-Gesternhaber. Dr. Posner-Gesternhaber is the founder and principal investigator of the Columbia Lighthouse Project at Columbia University. She is also a clinical professor in medical psychology of Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Posner-Gesternhaber was commissioned by the FDA to develop a scientific approach that has become the gold standard for suicide monitoring. The president of the American Psychiatric Association noted her work could be like the introduction of antibiotics. The U.S. Department of Defense said that her work is nothing short of a miracle. Dr. Posner-Gesternhaber is about to receive the Secretary of Defense Medal for Exceptional Public Service, the highest level of award a civilian can get for impacting the nation. Welcome to the show, Dr. Posner-Gesternhaber.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be with you today.
What are the reasons that teens or young adults want to commit suicidal overdose?
Well, teens, young adults, old adults, the biggest cause of suicide is this genetic treatable medical illness called depression, right? Brain-based illness, but we don't actually think of it like we think of cancer, right? You would never hear the word choice when it comes to cancer. So we know that the biggest cause is mental illness, most often of which is depression, and we need to connect people to the care that they need. Did you know actually that depression is the leading cause of disability across the globe? It actually costs humanity more than anything. But the very, very good news is that this is actually our one preventable cause of death.
What are I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and to prevent it, how we know how to prevent this thing that, you know, just takes countless lives unnecessarily is twofold. One is we need to find the people suffering in silence. 50% of people who die by suicide have seen their primary care doctor the month before they die. We need to be asking these questions about suicidal feelings and risk the way we monitor for blood pressure. But even that's not enough. You know, in our country, the Undersecretary of Defense wrote this urgent memo and said, you know, we must go beyond the medical model. It's not enough when, you know, my work is something called the Columbia Protocol, which is a few simple questions that's put in everybody's hands that from the janitor to the doctor and is rolled out across the world and really helping us address suicide. And the Department of Defense memo said it's not enough to have the primary care doctor use the Columbia or ask questions. We have to put it in everybody's hands, the legal assistant, the janitor, the peer, the friend. And so we know we have to go find people where they live. You know, people, when they're suffering in silence, are not going to come to you. So we know that identification and asking everybody is the first thing we need to do. And we need to ask in the right way. So the Columbia Protocol, for the first time, finds the needle in the haystack, finds the people at risk in this very precise way, and doesn't connect care, you know, unnecessarily to the people that don't need it. So now, it's the first time we have evidence-based thresholds for imminent risk. So the policeman doesn't have to take somebody to the hospital unnecessarily. And you know what happens when they do? It shuts that person down from treatment when they actually need it. So now, everywhere we can ask these questions, crisis lines, call centers, when somebody calls up poison control, they can ask those questions so we can really identify who's at suicidal risk. And let me tell you the importance, many of the reasons of the importance of asking. You know, the number one risk factor for who will die by suicide is a history of a suicide attempt. So asking everybody all the time is a critical thing we need to do. So So okay, we need to identify, and we've made lots of progress there, but we have lots more work to do to make sure that everybody can have this simple tool, for example. But the other thing we need to do is connect people to the care they need. We know, since we have modern antidepressants, Paxil, Prozac, etc., the suicide rate has dropped dramatically across the world, across ages, reversing a trend prior to their introduction. And then you say, okay, well, why do we still have a crisis or a problem with suicide? It's because most people who need treatment actually don't get it. 50 to 75
use this test?
Yes, parents, absolutely. Parents, kids, absolutely. And in the past, parents or the doctor, frankly, nobody wanted to ask because they didn't know what to do with the answers. So now you have the questions and you have the next steps. And so parents definitely can use it. And what I was starting to say is we need to make sure that people who are at risk and who are depressed actually get the help that they need, the treatment they need, for example, like antidepressants. And the thing that we know is that most people who need antidepressants don't actually get them because of stigma, because of not thinking about mental illness like a medical illness. So we really need to work on breaking down barriers of stigma and misunderstanding so all the people that need the treatment that will save their lives will actually get it. You know, when you think about opioid overdoses or any other kind of overdose, we know that a large majority or a good portion of them are suicides. And even when they're not suicides, there are people desperately trying to self-medicate in lieu of proper treatment.
What are the signs that parents need to look for in teens or young adults with suicidal thoughts?
Well, I think the first thing they need to understand is that the best thing anybody can do, any parent or any friend, is ask directly and not be afraid to ask. And ask matter-of-factly, like, how are you? And so people are using these specific questions, right, to figure out who's at risk. And what they are is, have you wished you were dead, or have you actually had thoughts of killing yourself? And if that's yes, have you thought about how you might do this? Have you had these thoughts and had some intention of acting on them? Or have you started to work out or worked out the details of how to kill yourself? And only if that second question, have you had thoughts of killing yourself, is yes, do you ask those next few? And then there's a question about behavior. Have you started to do anything, prepared to do anything, you know, to end your life? And what we're doing there in one simple question is getting at all the suicidal behaviors that we used to miss. Before, people would only ask about a suicide attempt, and then you missed the person who bought the gun or wrote the suicide note or collected the pills, things we absolutely cannot afford to miss. And so what we were missing before, of the 1% that are high risk, we were missing 87% of suicidal behaviors. And they're all, by the way, our science is showing us, even more predictive than a suicide attempt. So in a few simple questions, we really very potently identify suicidal risk. But the other thing I would say is, you know, what we know is that a common language is an intervention in and of itself, even though this is a potent common language. The other thing that, so ask directly. Don't be afraid to ask. People who are suffering want help, and including your children or your friends, and we know how to save a life. But also, if somebody, you know, when do you think about asking those kind of questions? You know, do they look different? Do they look down? Have they lost interest or pleasure in things? You know, you just know that their functioning isn't the same. They don't look the same, right? They're maybe irritable, withdrawn, you know, not sleeping the same. Those are the other kind of signs you would want to look for.
Are there medication that cause suicide?
No, interestingly, so there's been a lot of misunderstanding about that across the world. So I actually was the person who led the team that was commissioned by the FDA, you know, the United States Food and Drug Administration, to make sense of that. And the fact is, medications do not cause people to be suicidal. It's actually not treating depression that kills people. And we know that very clearly. Autopsy studies are always associated with lack of compliance or no treatment.
So depression is the main risk factor. We cannot observe like another disease such as bipolar disorder.
We know that 90% of people who die by suicide have a treatable mental illness, most often of which is depression. So 60% of the 90% is depression, and the rest is bipolar and other illnesses. So the overwhelming majority is depression, but also other mental illnesses can be absolutely the cause. Untreated mental illness is the cause. So, you know, I had a great fortune to give a speech to the leaders of the European Union on how to fight depression and suicide. And I said, you know, you can put up barriers on bridges or other things, but if you want to maximize impact, it's about treatment and identification. And as I said, though, most people who need it do not get it.
Why is it difficult for some individuals with suicidal thoughts or behavior to seek help?
Because they're in this biological, brain-based, you know, black hole of sadness, and most of the time they're just not able, right? They just want to end the pain, and we can't count on them coming and telling us when they're in this place, right? We need to come to them and ask, and again find the people suffering in silence.
What are some of the treatments for suicidal behavior and ideation?
Yes, so the thing we know is that modern antidepressants, you know, SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil, that's been incredibly effective. Since we have those medications, the suicide rate has dropped dramatically across the world, across ages, reversing a trend prior to their introduction. We also know that psychotherapies, you know, add to help with depression and treat depression and the associated suicidal issues, you know, and a combination is always really, really good. But antidepressants and treatment for mental illness are the number one thing that we need to think about. There are also evidence-based psychotherapies and things like, there's something called safety planning, which is a first crisis contact intervention that uses coping mechanisms. That's another wonderful thing to know about. There, people have made some progress on short-term treatment with ketamine for suicidal ideation and behavior. So those are some important things to mention.
And what are some things that parents could do to prevent suicide in their household?
You know, the two most important things are be aware, know to ask directly, and really understand when you see a loved one that looks not right or they're suffering, make sure to not let these barriers of misunderstanding and being afraid to know what to do with the answer, you know, think of this again like any other medical illness. Ask directly like we talked about, and make sure to be there for your loved ones and connect them to the care that they need if that's indicated.
At the beginning, you were talking about that some professionals have difficulty in recognizing signs related to suicide. Why do they have this difficulty?
You know, I don't think that they... Well, I think that there has been a lot of misunderstanding about the causes and what to do about it, and I think that we didn't necessarily know the questions to ask or even what to do with the answers, and people were afraid, if I ask, you know, what's going to happen. And now we've made a lot of progress in that, where we have a tool where you can ask, where you can know what to ask, you can connect the right people to care, you know, and in the past, you know, the policeman or the doctor didn't know who to help, so everybody would be brought to the hospital, and that makes people afraid to ask. But now, with a more precise tool, only 1% need a next step, so, you know, and we have the right questions, and it's connected to the next step, so all of those barriers are done away with, and people used to be afraid because of liability. How can I ask? What if something happens? So now they say, if you use this tool, it actually protects you, because it's the most evidence-supported thing we've had, and we have a responsibility to ask, even if we don't have a perfect formula. So I think having the right questions that that actually decreases workload as opposed to increasing it, you know, makes your job easier and helps to save lives is what's helped move that needle.
How could a governmental agency contribute to suicide prevention?
Yes, well, it's a great question, and I think that every government agency I've ever worked with, and I work with pretty much every country across the globe and every state in our own country in the United States, you know, everybody wants to make a difference. And where we see impact is policy. But I've also found that because with this tool, the Columbia Protocol, it's policy across most countries and all of our, you know, all of our country and all of our states, and that's really great. And policy, getting it in the hands of every doctor and every policeman and every jail and also every community member, and that's really so important. And what I've found is, you know, this is something where every member of the community can actually be part of the solution. So when you have communities that where bottom up meets top down, and it's a partnership with government, you know, is really great. And I've found government policy and really government implementation of policy, you know, so that we can really get these life-saving tools in the hands of everybody is what the most important thing, you know, government officials can do.
What was your reason for conducting research on suicidal risk assessment?
You know, I was the head of diagnostics at Columbia, and I was helping to run this national study on suicide attempters and intervention. And I just had no idea that I realized with all these leading international experts that there had never been anything to identify suicidal risk the way we needed to. And I'm a person who likes to, you know, save lives and have the biggest impact we can. So we just addressed a problem. And what was really exciting about it is that, you know, this is a preventable cause of death, and we saw a simple solution relatively to help do that. So, you know, I was helping run these national studies. It happened to be one of these, and we just went with rigor scientifically and figured out how to save lives.
Is there anything you would like to add, a final word or a website?
Yes. So please go to the Columbia Lighthouse Project, and it's cssrs.columbia.edu, and you'll see cards that can be put in every community member's hands, you know, that people can walk around with and figure out how to save lives. So people who are overdosing or doing anything else to end their lives unnecessarily can be identified and connected to the care they need. There are a few things in life that we have as clear or as simple of an answer about how we can help.
Thank you so much, Dr. Posner Gesternhaber, for giving us information on how we can prevent suicide in our household.
You're very welcome. It's really, really been a pleasure, and we're also here to be helpful to any community member in any system that wants to, you know, that needs any information.
Dr. Posner Gesternhaber is the founder and principal investigator of the Columbia Lighthouse Project at Columbia University. She's also a clinical professor in medical psychology of Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. That's all for today. I'm the Poison Terminator. I will be back next week with another episode. Have a great day.